Hey, Brendan.
Hello, Alan.
The Not a Thing podcast is up and running, and I did not notice actually what episode number we're on.
It doesn't matter what your episode number is.
So we'll just insert that episode number here, and then keep going. I'm really just extra excited, I guess, because I didn't have to prep any topics this week, so it was really easy for me.
Wait, was I supposed to prep topics?
Well, we've both sort of been prepping topics as we've been going for the last couple weeks. We've been thinking about doing this show for a little while, and it turns out we have an expert in the field with us. Say hello, expert in the field.
Well, hello, gentlemen.
That's it.
Hello.
Our dear friend and expert in the field, at least in Norway anyway, is for now anyway, is joining us this week. And Jürgen, what's the thing we're talking about?
Well, I've been asked to come in and talk about universal basic income. So I'm thinking expert may be pushing it, but it's. It's a field of interest.
To us.
Yeah,
it's a field. That's right. You can always compare.
We read an article about something that happened in China, which right. got us interested in this topic.
Right.
And so that's about as much information as I have. Like, that's interesting.
There's always a baseline. There's always a baseline that you compare yourself to.
And that baseline is me.
All right.
It's a low baseline.
Yeah, maybe let's back up and talk about that story just a little bit for the evolution of this topic anyway. What we'd found was this was about a month ago now, maybe a little bit more, a Foxconn factory. So Foxconn being that huge manufacturing conglomerate in China that makes pretty much anything with electronics in it. They certainly make all the iPhones, and I think they even make a lot of the Android phones as well. It's just a really, really big electronics manufacturing company. And one of their factories, they reduced the workforce from, I think it was 110,000 people to 50,000 people. So they eliminated 60,000 jobs. And they claim that was all through automation and mechanization of those jobs. And
first I want to say that I think someone needs to find out where the name Foxconn comes from, because I'm very sure that it was the last name that James Cameron struck off his list before he decided to go with Skynet. it's just such a futuristic anonymous, bleak, future conglomerate corporate name. It couldn't have been designed to send a less "we love humankind" message to the world.
Very Wayland Yutani.
Right. Yeah. But
yes, that is the story. That's,
yeah. And it got us thinking when, we joke about the robots coming for our jobs.
For our lives, Alan.
Right.
For our lives.
They start with the jobs, and then they take our snacks, and then they take our women, and in the end, what do we have left?
Wow, that is really bleak. But we're currently looking at, that was like a 50% workforce cut, It's literally our jobs being taken away by robots, and we were like, "Whoa, it's happening! It's really happening in China right now." There was another story later about, I think it was McDonald's saying, releasing in a earnings report or something to that effect that, or it may have been in reaction to the talking about. In the U.S., increasing the minimum wage to potentially $15, and how McDonald's was saying, well, we're prepared to, change our workforce in order to make that work, implying heavily a lot more automation and job loss.
Yeah, and when Seattle approved the ballot of introducing a minimum wage of $15, a robotics company in the Bay Area that the very next day saw a 300% spike in calls and interests from Washington-based companies, which was like a so obviously direct connection to it that it was kind of frightening.
Yeah, so what must we do to keep the robots from taking our jobs?
Well, and this is why we waited to do this show, is maybe they should. But if you're going to do that, there needs to be a system in place that protects people beyond John Connor.
Because the thing is that this, like, there are two aspects to this discussion. One thing is the robots are coming and taking our jobs, and then the other one is universal basic income. They're separate but linked topics, I think. And it's hard to discuss the robots taking our jobs without being labeled either a technology lover or a Luddite. I've seen all kinds of smart people going both ways on this robots discussion these days, in that Mark Andreessen, the guy who was early on Netscape and now runs a VC in Silicon Valley, he's like, well, the robots may be coming, but they're going to produce tons of other new jobs that we don't even know about yet, and it's going to be awesome. And then you have a lot of other people, such as, for example, this very in-depth study and report that came out of Princeton last year, which said that by 2030, 47% of the jobs that exist in America today, so not the number of positions, but the actual jobs, 47% of those will be done by robots or can be done by robots by 2030 already. And wow. they don't see new jobs appearing in the way that in the previous rounds, like when the spinning jenny was created and the Luddites stormed the factories and broke them because they wanted to spin by hand, then you could see other jobs appearing, and then they could move up, like from physical labor to more mental labor and to more problem solving and analytical type of jobs appeared. You even had the same thing with the internet, like when computers starting to become normal in the workplace and the homes, then other jobs would appear as well through the internet and that kind of stuff. But Princeton and those who are in their camp on this, they don't see new jobs appearing. So if they're correct, and naturally future foresight is a minefield to step into, but if they are correct, then there will only be jobs for half of us in 14 years, which is which makes you wonder what's going to happen to the economy, because robots don't buy products and robots don't pay taxes so much and make the market go actually around. So how are we going to make sure that the 47% who will then not have jobs have money to live off of?
Yeah, it's pretty wild. This is also coupled or came in and was very timely with a referendum in Switzerland to implement a basic income program. It ended up failing, I think, pretty heavily. I think it was 77 or 70, above 70% against.
Yeah, it was 77 against and 23-4.
And I think some people are holding that up. Oh, well, it's a colossal failure. But that means 23% of yes, the Swiss were like, oh, what is this universal basic income?
Right. And universal basic income is important to, like, in my opinion at least, universal basic income is not like one thing that everyone agrees on what is. It's not like a car is, it has four wheels and a steering wheel and a windshield. You can close the doors. It's not like this is what this is. It's a term that kind of describes a lot of different interpretations of what it means to give citizens a sum of money every month or every year. Or like people are saying Alaska actually has universal basic income already, because once a year everyone who lives in Alaska gets a check from the government for $2,200, which is income and interest from their oil and gas business taxation. But it's a concept that's been very little studied. And so when politicians discuss it, they often do so through extreme prejudice, even from like a socialist / communist angle, or from like a very, very conservative, fiscal conservative, this sounds like giving people free money, which, you know, in one sense it actually is, approach. But it has not been solidly tested as a model in a replicable form, but it is very much growing in popularity, because to me at least, it's the only alternative that's been put on the table of what to do when there are only jobs for half of us, because we gotta do something differently.
Oh, I would say that Christopher Nolan put up a pretty good alternative with The Dark Knight Rises, where the poor people will just kill all the rich people. that's an alternative.
Which also would battle inequality.
Right. I'm not saying it's ideal. But if you don't come up with a better solution, like, yeah, that could happen.
It's either that or universal basic income.
Your income or your life.
No, but there have been a couple of interesting, and this has been around since the 20s or 30s, I think, but it's mainly in the last couple of years with this rise of robotization and AI, which is becoming clearer and clearer. And you're starting to, as you say, this story in China, it's starting to become clear that this might actually be a reality. And then, so what are we going to do about that? And there have been a couple of experiments. And the one that I think is most interesting is this one that took place in Manitoba in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, where they over a five-year period gave the citizens of a little town with, I think, 10,000 people in it, they gave them a monthly check for 5 years, and they monitored and they tested and kept results and everything, but in a little bit uncontrolled ways. And then they didn't. The results from this test project were all kept by hand. And it seems documented by monkeys. So they put all of the documents in cardboard boxes and put them away. And then a woman who grew up in that setting in that time unearthed them. She became a scientist and she unearthed them and started digitizing it. And she found that in that period, teenage pregnancies went down, mental illness went down, divorce rates went down. High school graduations went up, so you had all these positive signs on like a larger systemic level, even though in a small test base. And then the biggest fear from anyone on the right side of the political spectrum is that if you start giving people money, they're not going to do jack shit. They're going to just lean back and put their feet on the table and not do nothing. And
jack shit the the technical economic term?
Some economists use it, okay. But not all of them.
That's a thing. It's a thing.
Yeah. Should I say anything and then I can edit in? It turned out in this particular instance, the people who quit their jobs, that was actually non-existent. There were some who went down in job percentage and spent more time with their families, but no one stopped working entirely. And I think the whole The whole biggest negative, there are two big negative arguments against universal basic income that I see repeatedly, and one is that, well, then no one's going to do anything. Everyone's just going to lean back and become lazy, and no one's going to do actual jobs. And the other one is that, well, this is just going to be way too costly. It's going to cost how we're going to finance something like that. And a counter argument to the first one is that we don't actually know if that's going to happen, but having lived and worked in Norway now for 13 years, which I realize is a little different from the US in some ways, I am not sure it's a bad thing if 50% of the workforce are offered to not work, because just out of like capabilities and like suitedness for jobs, etc., it might be nice if half the people didn't have to work, because then you kind of get the talented and eager 50% left, and you get those people who actually are really good at their jobs and actually really want to do their jobs and who feel an inner need to have jobs to fulfill themselves, who will do much better jobs instead of everyone. So you kind of get those people who just do a job because you got to have a job to get money to survive. You kind of get those out of the workforce.
Yeah, I see that as an absolute positive. I think there's a kind of understanding that there are kind of bullshit jobs, and that's the other big technical term that we're introducing this week.
Yeah,
but that there are jobs that are there because they have to exist from a kind of just because we have to create jobs, and jobs in and of themselves are worthy things to create, and productivity is so highly regarded,
right.
Even if actual productivity isn't really there, because it's subsistence productivity. It's like, it's productivity, like, I have to do this job or I will die.
Right.
And that's what, at least in the things that I've seen, that universal basic income kind of sweeps that out from under the leverage that companies have over people that are, in trouble or need to have that kind of subsistence jobs. And then what it does is those jobs, they can't just, pay people peanuts to do, a bullshit job. They have to actually make it attractive. So they have to pay it a living wage, or they have to make it so it's not like a 60-hour work week that's grueling. They have to refashion them in a way that makes it actually attractive to people.
And also, I think those BS jobs are also the first ones to be taken by robots in very many instances. but it kind of comes down to becoming like a moral and human development question, because so much of, at least in the Western world, so much of our character and our personality is now defined through our jobs. And if you don't work today, and I don't know how your job search is going, Alan, but I too soon will be unemployed. If you don't work, even more, if you like choose not to work or something, then people are like, why? You're taking a gap year. You're like, what, a sabbatical? What does that mean? What's wrong with you? And it's like, you're so many people in the Western world, and especially in the US, I think, are defining themselves through their work and through their work, their hard work and offerings and everything. And if you're offered the ability, the opportunity to not do that, and maybe like be a stay at home dad or a full time philosopher or gardener, or like weave baskets for people, and I don't know what else you would do with your time, I think it becomes a philosophical and very interesting question. Like, no, you no longer actually have to work to pay your bills and stuff like that. But it's also important to point out, like, any of them, and here we move into the second caveat people have against, is that it's going to be too costly and break the economy and how we're going to finance this and everything. It's not going to be $1 million to every person every year. Like the sums that some proponents have talked about is like $1,000 a month or something like that. And it also, again, has to be adjusted for probably geographies and maybe age and et cetera. But it's not going to be so much money that you can like move to San Francisco and put your feet up and eat fancy food and go shopping every day. Going shopping every day is not going to be what you fill your time with when you're doing
it. It'd just be enough to keep the wolves away from the door.
Right.
Yeah. One thing that I read,
specifically around like that, that idea that you would move to, you know, San Francisco or somewhere where the with a high cost of living, is that that would actually motivate people to move out of those places and move potentially to places where your universal basic income benefit would go further, and that could possibly change how, you know, where people live and what is considered like an attractive place to live, if the cost of living could be, you know, altered slightly anyway.
Right. And what was I going to say? One article talking about how to finance this thing, for example, in the US, and I have to say that I personally think that the U.S. will be one of the last countries to introduce this this platform, just because of the political spectrum and the whole kind of national mentality of how hard work is the way to personal success, mm-hmm. and you don't get anything for free and et cetera. But so I don't think the U.S. is going to be first in any way. I think China actually has some areas where they're experimenting with this already. And I think possibly Scandinavia and some European countries would be the first ones to do it, or Africa for that matter. They're doing an experiment also in Kenya at the moment. But in the US, for example, if you took the entire welfare system in the US, and the, so then you're talking about sick leave money, you're talking about food stamps, you're talking about unemployment benefits, you're talking about and Medicare, it's like everything that is spent on, and I'm not an economist, so I don't know if these numbers are correct, or but it, this was this guy's proposition, is you take all of that money, and instead of not just the money that's being paid out from the government, but also all the bureaucracy and the people employed to measure all those things and to keep track of the Medicare, like who's getting this much welfare and food stamps and do you qualify for all that, all of that entire apparatus, and you instead say that every person who lives legally in the US gets $1,000 every week, no matter where you live or what you do, this is what you get, and if you want to have more than that, then have a job in addition to it. If you're happy with that, then, you know, put your feet up and write songs about flowers and love. But that will remove that entire gigantic bureaucracy, which will save a ton of money. And it will add up to the money that you pay out through the universal basic income system, then will then roughly add up to the expenses of all those other welfare systems. So it will replace the systems that are already present.
That is really fantastic, because I read a similar article saying that that in order for that to work in the U.S., at least to be financially kind of make sense, it was that. So replacing all of the things that are listed as like wealth transfer programs, so welfare, food stamps, all of those different systems, even unemployment, mm-hmm. and completely removing them, just the bureaucracy alone that is involved in that would mean that more money is actually flowing to the people that would benefit from it. So even if it was just that, even if it just did that, it would it could be you know, a sweeping welfare reform or pitched in that way. I think a lot of the arguments in that are showing it as a welfare reform method, and I think it certainly makes sense as that. What is also interesting is that it's not just going to people that are quote unquote, you know, poor. One of the big things in welfare reform is there what are called welfare cliffs, or different where there are multiple programs that are available to people, and depending on your income threshold, there are like weird breakpoints for when if you make, you know, $1 over this threshold, you are no longer eligible for all of these programs. And then that actually puts you below where you would be because you're not getting assistance. And so getting rid of those cliffs, or at least making it a smoother transition, would remove people from the welfare trap, as it's sometimes called.
Yes. And it's, no one, I haven't done a ton of research on this, but I read a lot about it over the last year, but not like structured research. And it seems to me that no one sat down and actually done the full scientific approach to this. Like, what would it mean from geography to geography? Like, how much would it mean in Tennessee? How much would it mean in New York? How much would it mean in California? And it's just such a huge systemic tool to implement that just the thought of it makes me dizzy and I have to sit down. But there, as I said earlier, you're moving up towards like one futuristic scenario of this is that it's the only thing that can actually make the economy go round once the robots come and take all of our jobs.
Well, that's one of the things I think that's really interesting and that is hopeful coming out of the Swiss vote is that, you know, there was kind of a groundswell of at least 23% of the people.
23% of the Swiss population. And they're not the most open to change, but they thought that this was a good thing to explore. And it has to be said, this was like a ballot. So this is one guy who fought to make it happen, and the entire political establishment thought this was a ridiculous idea.
Well, but it at least means at least the groundswell means that there's interest, and ideally that would mean there's hopefully funding available or people that are willing to look into it. So you mentioned there were a couple places where it's being piloted, and I think that's, you know, really, really important, because a lot of what we're talking about, a lot of the arguments against it, are really just based on feelings and politics.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Instead of data.
Yes.
Go figure.
Yes.
No, it's the same as the problem with marijuana being a Schedule I narcotic. They can't do any research to figure out whether it actually has the benefits that people say it does.
Like, because the subjects are too lazy to show up.
Oh, because they're legally not allowed to.
Oh yeah. We're looking for test subjects.
Yeah.
Are there any marijuana smokers here? No. No, no. Are you a police officer? But
you gotta tell me if you're a cop.
you actually don't.
That's a classic.
That's a pretty good myth to debunk, is that asking a person if they're a cop does not guarantee that they have to tell you the truth.
What? That's what undercover means. but there is going to be a pilot program in Finland, and when this was announced, it was like touted in the international press as like Finland's introducing universal basic income, and either depending on what end of the political spectrum you were on, they were either ridiculed or applauded for it. And then I talked to a couple of think tanks and politicians, and I actually talked to talked to Bruce Orrek, who's the former U.S. ambassador to Finland. He's quite a character. You should look him up. He became famous for his bare-chested Christmas cards. He's a bodybuilder, and he
is... Oh, we'll link to that in the show notes. Don't worry.
Yeah, please do that. He's awesome. And had a really good conversation with him about it. And he was saying, and so did the think tank that I talked to as well, actually backed up on this, in that this, they are not doing it. It's not like approved and introduced or anything like that. It's a small pilot program where they are going to, for the next couple of years, give a little test group of like 2,000 families or people universal basic income of something equivalent to $1,200-$1,300 a month, and they're gonna try to test it as replicably as possible so that you get solid good data of like how does that affect the lives that people live and the decisions that they make. And there was a lot of debate in Finland, again along the political spectrum, because some people on the left side are, or most people on the left side are saying that this is a good tool to battle inequality and it'll free up people to do what they want. And in the future, we're going to have to do this anyway, where people on the right side are saying, but we're giving people money for nothing. It's going to take completely away their incentive to work. And
yeah, the counter argument to that is, but you're going to take away their ability to work when you give all their jobs to robots.
Exactly. And to me, that's like the... that's like the base argument of why I think this needs to be explored. And I'm not necessarily a proponent of the platform, because I think the platform is so undefined and unbacked up by data, but I'm a proponent of exploring it a lot more seriously because robots. I mean, if Princeton's correct, and there are a lot of smart people who work at Princeton, and if they are correct, and in 14 years there will only be jobs for half of us, then we need a backup plan. And politicians naturally don't think so much about what happens in 14 years, because they know that most of them will be out of office by then. They care mostly about what happens in the next 2 year or 4 year election cycle. But this particular thing is something that needs to be taken seriously, because you're seeing broadly in a lot of markets, you're seeing that the unemployment rate is not going down massively. It's actually going up. You see things, examples like this one in China. You're seeing the middle class being left behind, and wealth is being centralized on a few people. And the companies that are taking over that have now the highest capital gains and the highest income and the biggest valuations and everything are companies with a lot fewer actual human jobs than previously. I mean, I think I read somewhere that, for example, Google and Facebook have a lot fewer actual employees than what General Motors or General Electric had 40 years ago, or even like the giant oil and gas companies. And I think that's a pointer towards the future, that technology is doing much more of the work for us, and that that productivity is going to go up without producing jobs. And so it looks to me like, at least my opinion, is that this is something that we have to start exploring.
But I mean, why would humans, or when would humans ever bury their heads in the sand and not pay attention to a large and looming problem that
I know, involves? Right?
Good thing I don't have to worry about that.
I'm sure someone will deal with that very soon.
John Connor.
Very soon. Yes,
John Connor. No, we need to stop it before we get to John Connor time.
Float Skynet.
Well, I think it's at least encouraging that people are exploring it. There is a company. Well, it's sort of like a VC. So Y Combinator, the Yahoo kind of not exactly
investment
VC
arm,
but they're what's the word I'm looking for? Not think tank, incubator. Really? That's the term. They so
like Yahoo Ehrlich Bachmann incubator?
That's exactly yes, what I thought.
Exactly. Aviato.
Aviato. The Aviato spin-off Y Combinator. Why not Combinator?
Their task is to go and find small companies and ideas and fund them and see if they can turn them into something actionable from a corporate level. In this case, what they're doing is they're looking into a pilot program in Oakland to do universal basic income for, you know, it's a small program. I think it's just 1,000 people. But I think they're more focused not necessarily on the impact of what it does to people from a economic or societal perspective. I was reading their involvement specifically to see what the logistics are and just to make sure that they could reliably give $1,000 to a person and that that person actually receives it and there's not fraud involved or there's not holes that people could use to rip people off or pretend, you know, you're another person and get a second check, or that you have 15 kids and that you would deserve 15 checks. So I think it's really important to study it from a lot of angles, not just from a macro perspective about like what it does to the culture and the sentiment and the economy, but really how do you actually give people money in a reasonable and reliable way?
Yep.
And that's been an issue in China where they do have in some areas a minimum income. It's not a lot. It's only like $150 a month or that equivalent. So like $5 a day extra. But the World Bank did a study on that program, and they were saying that only $1 to $2 of every $10 spent was actually getting to the people in poverty.
Hmm.
And so there it's used as a bureaucracy and corruption.
Right. Yes.
So there it's used as a tool against poverty, which I think is also interesting, because what a lot of people are saying who hate the universal basic income aspect, what they're saying is a better tool is the negative income tax, which is basically that it's not, then you end up not giving money to people who actually have jobs and have good income and money at the moment, but you give money to the people who don't have, and then that in a much better way fights inequality and battles inequality systemic.
But doesn't that assume a balanced tax structure?
A functioning tax structure, yes.
Yeah.
Are you sure you want to come back to the United States? Right, the tax code is a whole other thing, and every time I've heard that explored, the negative income tax as a way to balance equality, the first thing I think of is that the example that you're giving for how to deal with tax is not how tax works. Tax code is so crazy, and I mean, we have to pay people to do our taxes for us because it's so insane. That's certainly an issue. I think another thing that that easily spins out of this is healthcare and how that's handled in many countries. In the United States, it's obviously still kind of a mess. So a slightly better mess than it was, thanks Obama, but. it's certainly a far cry from where it is in a lot of other countries. I've heard that
the rest of the industrial world,
yeah, that quite often when universal basic income is brought up, is that it's being explored in a country which also has single payer healthcare, and the U.S. definitely does not have that, and so that's another thing which may not be a requirement, but it's probably something that has to be at least considered when figuring out how to do it.
I think it's. Go ahead, Brendan.
It'd be interesting to see with these pilot programs that they're doing, seeing what other kind of effects that it has on things like health, not even just the healthcare system. I mean, like on people's health or society in general. When you have people who are able to stay home more and parent.
Right.
And be able to spend more time taking care of their health.
Exactly. There's I think the reason it's gonna take off in a much smaller country than the US is because you kind of need an autonomous population who are not too different in culture and needs and lifestyles and wealth and everything you need, like, and not to say that there aren't differences in between rich and poor in Finland or Norway or Switzerland or the 10 people who live in Liechtenstein, but but I think it's going to kick in for a country much smaller than the US first, and then be seen as a test ground for this to function before it. Like, the US is kind of like the ultimate frontier on this because it's so big and complex. But I think
I think you really nailed it about the just the cultural kind of valuation of work and how it really is more and more defining how, or is being used to define how people like are. What do you do is a common kind of thing that you say when you're at a cocktail party, you know, and it is weird if you say, I don't work. That's like, what do you do should not necessarily just mean what do you work on. It should be everything that you do. But
yeah, I agree.
So, I think having many more, pilots, even looking to, implementations. But the thing that I've read is that so many of those, those multi-year studies, like the one in Canada, it was 5 years, and that it can take a lot longer to see how something like this actually has an effect.
Yes.
And you only what is it, 14 years?
Yeah.
We're in a race.
That's the point about like how the long-term effects, like what are the long-term effects for a person or for a family if the parents of the family don't have to worry about paying their bills, if they know that they get money every month that covers the basic bills, the electricity, rent, and transport and stuff like that, so that they can think about other ways. They can like concentrate on being a family or on raising kids, on being good to each other. And there's a guy called Nick Hanauer who was one of the early people in on Amazon.com and made a ton of money off of that, and some other ventures as well. And he is, so he's very rich, but he has taken this whole stand about the richest people in the US need to think differently about how we're treating society because the pitchforks are coming. It's just one of his he's got a TED talk on it, and called My Fellow Billionaires, The Pitchforks Are Coming. And he is a big proponent of the minimum wage. So he doesn't talk about the universal basic income, but he is a big proponent of the minimum wage. And he talks about the vulture economy, which is companies that take advantage of actually government programs like food stamps and similar ones too. So they pay their workers so little that their workers and employees actually have to go on food stamps and government assistance programs just to get by. And he brings out Walmart as the biggest and baddest wolf of the lot. And he has this thought experiment, which I think is really interesting, because Walmart is the biggest employer in the US with I think 1.5 million people working for him. And actually 2.5 million, but he said 1.5 million of those are being paid so poorly that they also have to go on food stamps or have second jobs on the side just to be able to feed their families. And so he has this thought experiment where he says, if Walmart paid those 1.5 million American employees $10,000 more per year, so each of those employees would get $10,000 more per year, then all of them would be taken above the poverty limit. They would be able to quit their second jobs or go off government welfare, so save the government a ton of money. They would be able to spend time with their kids, which means their kids would do better in school. They would have less stress and worry about making the next rent or electricity bill or phone bill or anything like that. So they would lead better and more fulfilled lives themselves. They would do a better job for Walmart because they'd be able to concentrate on their own jobs much more. And they would have more money to buy products at Walmart or other companies. It would lead to, you know, increase in the economy or actually bring money back into the market. And if Walmart did this, their annual profit would still be $15 billion. And to me, that becomes just a moral question. Like, why on earth are Walmart not doing this? To me, it's just no company of that size and everything needs to make that much money on at the cost of society and at the cost of the government and, you know, those kids' futures and their employees and everything. And I think although he makes his point towards minimum wage, I think it is a question that also relates, or it's an example that also relates in towards the universal basic income debate.
Wow. Well, so when you come back to the United States, are you running for president? And can I vote for you? Is that?
I don't think so.
You have 100% favorability ratings on this podcast.
Thank you.
We'll just ignore the constitutional thing about you needing to be born here.
Whatever. There's that. I'm going to be reading a lot of books to kind of back up all my lofty claims with the facts. But as Stephen Colbert says, facts have a well-known liberal bias.
Awesome. Well, Jürgen, it was a blast having you on the show again. I think we just really like you on the show. It's good.
Well, I'm happy to take part, guys. It'll be even better without the time difference, I think, in the future. So anytime. It's always a pleasure.
Now, what time is it there now?
Now it is closing up on 7 o'clock in the morning.
Has the sun risen yet?
Sun has not gone down, Alan. It's summer in Norway. The sun never sets.
It's like living in the British Empire.
Yes, it is like living in the British Empire. And then in the winter, it is not. Although, do you want to be living in the British Empire these days? I don't not know.
No, I'm thinking of days of old, you know, when they actually had an empire.
The empire days.
Yes, summer is like living in the old British Empire. Winter is like living in the old Soviet Union.
Yes, it was pretty funny. Not that I should plug another podcast on your podcast, but I was listening to a podcast called Intelligence Squared, which is British intelligent debates with learned people and academics and politicians and everything. And they were talking about the post-Brexit. And one of the people from the UK Independence Party, who was naturally a huge proponent of leave,
right,
he was saying, well, this is not a problem, not being part of the single market, because there are so many other countries in the world who already have offered to have independent trade deals with England, such as, I can name many of them, well, not India, because this and this and that, and not Australia, because this and this and that, and not this other one. And I was like, you realize that you're naming all of the old colonies, yes, and I think I know why they're not interested.
Oh, yes, there are many bridges to be unburned by the British.
Yeah, they burned a bridge too far.
They got some challenges.
Well, we're glad to have you on the air. We're glad to have you be a part of our march to episode 200. Brendan, we're still on the way there, I think.
Are we there?
Do you know now?
No.
Do you know what episode we're in now?
I haven't been. We're on a third
episode here.
Well, we'll keep doing fun stuff like this up to and then after episode 200. So keep tuned to the Not a Thing podcast. Tweet at us, Facebook us. We'll probably do another show when Jürgen's on this side of the time zone.
This is episode 193, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
We've got school on our own podcast.
We never purport to be experts. That was never a thing.
I never purport to be good at math, so.
Well, thanks a lot, fellas, and I guess we'll be calling it a day soon. So I'll be going about on my today, Thursday here, and we'll talk later.
Right on.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Absolutely. Bye,
Brendan. I will talk to you next week.
Till next time, Alan.